From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A college professor's recent New York Times column shined light and generated heat in the debate over ideological diversity on campus. He'll discuss the column and the controversy it caused. State lawmakers agree North Carolina counties should replace voting machines that have no paper record. The outstanding question is when. You'll hear debate. The controversial State House vote to override Governor Cooper's budget veto has led to a war of words between the House's top Democrat and its top Republican. And we'll learn about potential unintended negative consequences of a government push for more electric vehicle use. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
One more thing, or perhaps two, or even more than that. That's the shorthand headline out of the UNC system with the leadership changes that we've learned about. Reporters at Carolina Journal, the first to learn about several major developments. Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson joins us now to talk about what is happening with the system in North Carolina as we see people moving in and out. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
So the Board of Governors met just a few days ago, and all sorts of things happened during a couple of days that they were meeting. Set the stage for us with reporters from Carolina Journal being over there. It looks like chancellors were having their say, and a little bit of rumblings of unhappiness among chancellors.
Right. There are openings at several universities in the system that have been vacant for a long time. Western Carolina is the prime example of that, where the chancellor's position has been open for, I guess, going on 2 years now after the former chancellor passed away from cancer. And there was a lot of jostling back and forth about who wanted to be the chancellor, including presumably a couple of members of the Board of Governors who were looking at that. The chancellor's position at the University of North Carolina's flagship campus at Chapel Hill has been open since Carol Folt walked away under pressure after the Silent Sam incidents there. Then the president's position of the entire system is being held down by interim Bill Roper. The physician, Dr. Roper, was head of the UNC healthcare system for about 20 years. And so there was a lot of turmoil, and the chancellors at the meeting, at the first day of the two-day meetings, basically sat up and said, look, whoever is going to run this system eventually needs to be a person who has the confidence of the chancellors, the confidence of the faculty, and some thought that he's going to bring some stability, because the board has been accused, rightfully so, of micromanaging in individual campus affairs. And the Board of Governors doesn't usually do that sort of thing. So the chancellors were upset. And when that happened, the next day, we get word that there was some additional disruptions taking place. The board came out with a new policy that new chancellors would be hired. There would be an incentive-based pay system for them to some extent, in which they would be rewarded for graduation rates, for recruitment and retention of students and things like that. And Dr. Roper made a statement during the press availability afterward that with chancellors, we're going to pay them for performance. We don't pay people for breathing, which may have been a subtle shot at some of the Board of Governors members who may have been interested in becoming chancellors as some sort of cushy job. So that drew some additional grumbling. And then things took off from there.
Well, let's talk about some of those things, because there are big news in North Carolina. First of all, the chairman of the Board of Governors, and keep in mind, this is a very powerful, very influential, sought-after position. When you get it, you usually don't leave it unless you're pushed out. But Harry Smith says he's leaving the leadership role, staying on the board.
Yes.
Why? Why is he going?
Well, he says he has other business interests and wants to spend more time with his family. That's sort of a stock answer, but said he's got new business ventures he's getting involved in, that the Board of Governors leadership is taking up way more of his time than he thought it would and way more than he can afford to have it take up. And so he's going to step down effective the 1st of October, which may be after this program airs. But nonetheless, he will be remaining on the board. He has recommended that the vice chairman, Randy Ramsey, be named as his successor. Now, Ramsey and Smith are very, very close. There's some factions on that board. But Smith, of course, has been a source of controversy for quite a while.
Why is that? What about him? Is it his personality?
That
is
has
it
something
his
to do with
his decision making? What?
A lot of different things. First of all, he came in. He's sort of a bull in a china shop. He came in there to change things, to make things different, to get people uncomfortable, and he certainly did that. He had an awful lot to do with, I think, the departure of President Margaret Spellings, who left at the first of the year, and now that's why Bill Roper is there. He was involved very intimately in business at East Carolina University, which is where he's an alumnus, but he's a member of the Board of Governors of the entire system. He has supposed to have no direct role in East Carolina. Was involved with the departure of their former chancellor, Cecil Staton. And ECU has an interim chancellor now, down Gerlach. And so Smith was a disruptive force. Sometimes disruptive forces, though, you have, you know, if somebody makes a mess, somebody has to clean it up. And the messes haven't always been cleaned up.
Rick, why did Harry Smith believe that he needed to shake things up? What was the problem there?
Part of that came from the leadership of the General Assembly, because you'd had in the past, you'd had Tom Ross, who was summarily dismissed from the president's position before Harry Smith was chairman of the Board of Governors, was seen to be someone as a go-along, get-along, someone who was going to kowtow to the left-leaning faculty and the left-leaning chancellors and the like. And so they wanted someone who was more performance-based, someone with a stronger business background, and someone who is going to be seen as introducing entrepreneurial aspects into UNC's operations. Now, he did a lot. I mean, the board accomplished a lot of those things. They've kept tuition under control. They convinced the General Assembly to do the North Carolina Promise Program, which is the $500 tuition per semester at several institutions, and we're hoping to get more to embrace that model. There are a lot of positive things that were done while Harry Smith was the chairman of the Board of Governors, but unfortunately, because he tended to be a lightning rod, he couldn't get out of his own way to some extent in these things, and that tended to knock the positive news out of the headlines. And he claimed it was sort of like a media conspiracy against him or whatever, but basically, you know, these things could have been done with much more fanfare and could have really shown a stronger face for UNC, and that's unfortunate.
Now, while all of this is going on, of course, there is a major search underway for the next leader of the UNC right. system. This is considered a plum job. If you ask anyone who's in academia whether they agree or disagree with what happens on North Carolina campuses, they will tell you that a lot of people in this country will want to have that job. So the search is underway. There had been some talk that maybe one or more members of the Board of Governors might be interested in that. There had been talk as well that Dr. Bill Roper, the interim president of the system, might want the gig permanently. But then came news from him.
That's right. The day after Harry Smith announced he was stepping down as chairman of the Board of Governors, Dr. Roper announced that he was going to be leaving as the interim president June 30th of next year. The search committee, which is led by Kim Strack, the former executive director of the State Board of Elections, was going to start a formal has already started a formal search, but the actual process was going to get really into the nitty gritty with, you know, interviews, in person interviews and things like that in the spring. And Dr. Roper said, in June, I'm out of here. That's my time. He was originally going to retire as the president of, or as the head of UNC Healthcare in May of this year before he took the presidency of the whole UNC system. So it's not as if that there was thought that he would be a long timer unless he expressed an interest in actually doing the job permanently. But Dr. Roper will be 71 when next year comes around. So it would be unusual for him to take on a job like that for more than a couple of years anyway.
Rick, despite the fact that this is considered really a job that many people in academia would want, leading the UNC system with its reputation, is there any concern or is Carolina Journal getting any rumblings behind the scenes that because of what's happened with the role of Harry Smith and some of the turmoil that has been happening over the past months, that that might put off some people who otherwise would be interested in leading the system?
Well, you've heard a lot of we've heard a number of people say privately that they would not serve in senior positions at UNC campuses as long as the current structure of leadership was there at the Board of Governors. And it goes beyond Harry Smith. And so we'll see.
You read it all at CarolinaJournal.com, as well as the monthly print edition. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to CarolinaJournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at CarolinaJournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A tenured professor at Sarah Lawrence College wanted to raise awareness about the imbalance of ideological viewpoints on campus. But when Samuel Abrams wrote about the issue for the New York Times, he unleashed a series of criticisms. The James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal invited Abrams to Raleigh to tell his story. Why bring attention to ideological diversity?
A big part of it has to do with the fact that I've spent years looking at why our society is seemingly so polarized and why we have so much anger in this country. And when I realized that we're not able to talk and that we're shutting down discourse and debate, I realized that's going to hurt our ability to build meaningful connections with others, meaningful neighborhoods, meaningful communities. And I said, geez, education is really the cornerstone to being able to have these conversations, which lead to, again, a healthy and virtuous civic life. And if we're not able to have that education and do what we're supposed to do on higher ed campuses, which is debate, argue, question, and do so openly without fear of reprisal and retribution, even if the idea is seemingly unpopular, then our future as a nation is at stake. Now, that may sound extreme, how I'm tying, you know, my little corner of the world and free speech and viewpoint diversity into the health of this nation. But I do believe that if we can't talk, then our nation's great democratic experiment really is at risk. So I'm hopeful that people will hear just how important it is that we maintain the ability to debate and have this discourse, because we're never going to solve our nation's problems if we can't.
Why take this issue to the New York Times?
The New York Times is our newspaper of record for the nation. It's widely read, and it has an editorial board that I very much admire. One of the things about its editorial board is that they've told me on a number of occasions that their mission is to publish things that people need to hear, that people need to read, and that people need to talk about. So when I explained to the board my research and presented them with this problem, I'm very grateful that they said, yes, this is something we need to talk about. You know, at its very core, viewpoint diversity has nothing to do with a particular ideology. While a lot of folks who are right of center, you know, like to talk about it because college campuses are overtly progressive, no one should have a problem with viewpoint diversity. No one should have a problem with this statement, ideas should be able to be debated and aired freely. If you do have a problem with that, we should talk, because this, again, is the benchmark to how we progress as a society. Ideas are only as good as they are if they can stand up to very aggressive challenge and debate. And no one should have a problem with that if you're on the left or the right. It should be a universal ideal, especially on our higher ed campuses. That is what our mission statements in most cases are about. Not every school has a mission statement like that. Some are much more technical in orientation, but most, especially those who do humanities and the liberal arts, really value debate, and I'm trying to protect that debate.
What was your message to New York Times readers?
One of the key ideas with the New York Times piece was to indicate that there are a number of very important groups on our college and university campuses, and we often forget one of them. We always think about the students. Students are front and center. We also hear about presidents and provosts. They make a lot of noise. They get a lot of attention when they speak. They can shift the ground. And then, of course, we hear about our faculty, the ones who do a lot of the teaching. But when you are removed from higher ed, you don't really realize that there's another powerful group. And that very powerful group is this very large group of what I call mid-tiered student-facing administrators. There are huge, millions of them. They set the tone and tenor of what goes on college and collegiate life generally, from orientation programs, which are huge, by the way, because a student comes in and is then told, here's what college is about, here's how to think about things, to how conflict and ideas are managed and debated in residence halls and dormitories, to campus community centers, whether it's a Jewish center, an LGBTQA plus center, an African American center, to a student success center. These places, these individuals are everywhere. They set the tone, the tenor, the rules of what of engagement and what can be talked about and how it can be talked about. And too few people realize how powerful they were. So the Times piece really had two key pieces to it. The first was to recognize there's this pillar of people that have a huge influence that we need to remember are very real and very powerful. And then the fact that they are a very progressive and the most progressive left-leaning group of people on campus. It's important to mention that they don't come into their jobs necessarily trying to shut down debate. They just may not realize it. If everyone is incredibly left of center and they're surrounded by other people who are left of center, they may not realize that their programming is lopsided. And that's what I said in the piece. It was not to indict them for being evil or doing anything bad. Very important distinction that I don't think they're intrinsically evil at all. It's to say that the material and how they're going about their jobs, I think, is unbalanced, and that we need to make a correction and try to bring more balance in. And that was the goal of the piece.
We're speaking with Samuel Abrams, professor at Sarah Lawrence College and recent featured speaker in Raleigh for the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. People could have reacted to your column by saying, no, you're wrong, but that's not what happened.
Yes, I expected a lot of people to say, no, you were wrong. Very few people have. Also, when you're in higher ed, the cardinal virtue of something is to say, aha, maybe that's wrong. How are you wrong? Let me show you why you're wrong. Let me give you some other evidence to the contrary. Let me present you with a narrative that says, actually, they're more centrist, or even in some cases, right of center. I didn't see any of that. No one has been able to vigorously or really challenge the narrative whatsoever. Instead, sadly, it appears as if administrators at Sarah Lawrence and students, I don't know the details exactly, but wanted to come after me, and basically I have received numerous threats and property destruction and harassing phone calls, slanderous allegations, and so on. It's been pretty unpleasant. At the same time, it sort of proves my point of why viewpoint diversity is under attack. Many people think that if you challenge the prevailing wisdom, there could be consequences. There have been consequences to me. That's been unambiguously clear. And sadly, it makes a case for why people are afraid to call out another form of injustice, which is what this is when you have an imbalanced intellectual environment.
You're willing to talk about this experience, but what kind of impact does it have on others?
I think, for better or for worse, the impact is it promotes silence and it promotes conformity with the prevailing behavior and outlooks on our college and university campuses. That all being said, the reaction to this piece has been shockingly huge. I've received tens of thousands of emails in support from parents, from students, from other administrators, from faculty, from board of trustees members to various presidents, to the general public on the whole. And I think by shining a light on this problem, people have suddenly realized, yes, there really is an issue. Yes, we really do need to address it. Addressing it's going to take time. It's going to be painful. It's going to be very, very slow. But I think it's now in the public's consciousness. I think people are aware that viewpoint diversity is a real problem. We need to have more of it. The absence of it, again, harms our community, harms our educational experience, harms our ability to be civic in this country. And schools are reacting to it. There are groups like the Heterodox Academy and FIRE and the American Council of Trustees, ACTA, and others that are working very hard to make these changes. And I think generally in the world of ideas, this is an idea that people are now beginning to accept as there is this group of people. They have some power. We need to monitor them a little more carefully. We need to modify how they behave to promote this sort of real and positive academic and intellectual environment.
That's Professor Samuel Abrams of Sarah Lawrence College. He spoke recently in Raleigh about viewpoint diversity. His presentation, sponsored by the James D. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers want counties to get rid of voting machines that have no paper ballots. The only real question is when. After a series of delays, counties had been expected to make the change for the 2020 election cycle, but they sought another extension. Some lawmakers, like Democratic State Representative Chaz Beasley, want only a short extension.
The two concerns that I heard yesterday were pretty much in these two categories, that there would be a major time crunch if the boards of elections for our local counties would have to create new machine processes in a very short period of time after having several elections in many cases. And the second big category that these fell into was the concern about unfunded mandates. And so what this amendment would do is that it would strike a balance. It would provide a compromise that would recognize that our boards of elections are in many cases stretched thin. If they're in the 3rd district or in the 9th congressional district, they may have as many as 3 elections in the next 2 months. That's a lot for them, and then they would have to turn around and switch out their machines thereafter. So this provides a 6-month extension. The extension would be optional. It would be at the request of local boards. It would make clear that our intent as a General Assembly is that we move to more secure systems that are paper-based. And it would also allow for human-readable receipts to be a key factor in whether or not the State Board of Elections grants any extension.
Other lawmakers don't believe counties ought to be forced to switch out voting machines before the 2020 election. Republican Dennis Rydell.
I've talked to my local board of director about this proposal, and they assured me that changing in the middle of the 2020 election cycle would actually be more difficult than just staying with the DRE machines and more problematic for them. You're asking the counties that have pushed legislation that did pass the House, by the way, to the delay of the decertification, you're asking them now to, I think in haste, make a very important decision of one of three voting machine systems, when in fact they know their current DRE machines. They know what to expect. They know how to maintain them. They know how to have them properly calibrated. They know the lifespan available. And instead go into an entirely new set of machines that we as a state have no history with. It seems to me that it would be better to defer to the local boards of elections across our state, 20 plus counties, who are requesting and seeking this delay, to let them have the delay through the 2020 cycle alone, and then they have to replace their machines. And there might even be additional machines that would be certified by that time.
Beasley's amendment failed, but lawmakers still want counties to switch to paper ballots after the 2020 election cycle. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week and listen to Headlock too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The controversial State House vote to override Governor Roy Cooper's budget veto has led to a war of words between the House's top Democrat and its top Republican. Democratic leader Darren Jackson started the war with a news conference. He referenced video footage from the day of the vote.
The House prays and does the pledge. Then Representative Sain comes in from the side and immediately takes his seat. The speaker's attorney speaks to him, and Sain never looks up. He is recognized for the purpose of a motion and reads a motion, apparently from his phone. If not planned, how did the speaker know to call on Sain? How did the speaker know the purpose that Sain wanted to be recognized for, or what motion he was going to make? How did Representative Sain know exactly what to say? Most telling is the reaction of all the other House Republicans in the chamber. Remember, the speaker said they were, quote, genuinely confused and surprised? See the video for yourself. That is clearly not the truth. They sit there listening intently, and no one has any reaction of surprise. There is no confusion, no reaction at all, no questioning to their seatmate. What did Jason just say? No facial expression changes, no looking around like, what is happening?
Jackson reaches a harsh conclusion.
We have been lied to and misled. Republicans couldn't get the votes necessary on the policy. Then they tried to simply buy members off. They still couldn't get to 7. Then their win-at-all-cost strategy began. House Democrats have gone to extraordinary lengths to attend all voting sessions. This includes returning early from major surgery, leaving the hospital bedside of spouses, missing doctor's appointments, work obligations, family vacations, first days of school, and many other reasons. The fact that almost no House Democrats were present would indicate to anyone that we had been told that there would be no votes. So where do we go to heat from here in the State House? I did not see any path forward to reconciliation so long as the Republican leadership and their offices continue to lie about what happened. I believe that Republican House leaders have consistently lied for 2 weeks now. If they still dispute this, I would challenge their leadership to take a lie detector test. Let me write the questions, and I will gladly pay for it.
Republican State House Speaker Tim Moore issued a quick response.
Representative Jackson contends that Representative Singh was reading from his phone the motion. Look, that isn't true. How do I know? I was there. Representative Jackson wasn't there. I was there doing my job on that day. And where did the motion come from? It came from me giving it to my chief of staff, who physically walked it over to Representative Singh for him to read from. And the video should show that. So you'll be able to see that as well. Why did we give it to Representative Singh? Well, the majority leader wasn't present. The rules chair wasn't present. Speaker pro tem wasn't present. In fact, we had 10 members out. You know, I've been in this General Assembly since 2003. I like to think I know the rules a little bit. If there was a plan to override a veto, don't you think I would have tried to have us at full strength? Don't you think I would have at least have had a quorum present of Republicans? Look, if the Democrats had walked off the floor, that would have shut the thing down. This was one of those things where we came to a session, walked on the floor. The first thing that I did was I asked the House Principal Clerk, did we notice this as a no-vote session? Remember, I did not preside the day before. I confirmed with the clerk, no such notice ever went out. It was a regularly scheduled voting session. In fact, a number of Democratic members were there on the floor. One of the Democratic members, in fact, came to me and wanted to know, where are my colleagues? Aren't we voting?
Moore went beyond rebutting Jackson's specific points.
Here's what I think, though, is disturbing. For a member of the House, come here on a week that we're in recess, for a member to come in, make these allegations, which aren't accurate, which can be disproven, with no notice, no opportunity, not even having a discussion about it, just that says something. I've been up front and straightforward with you guys from day one. I've said from the beginning, when I saw a chance to take a vote, I would do it. Now, we've had plenty of no-vote sessions. You all have covered those. We had one just the other day. Well, we announced no votes. And guess what? We don't have votes. And even though the veto rode the calendar for, what was it, 2 months nearly, on no vote session days, we didn't take a vote, period. So, yeah, I think Representative Jackson clearly has to know better. Is he desperate to keep his job in the caucus? I don't know. I don't know what it is. Those are questions others can ask. But a couple other things that I'm going to mention when we talk about integrity and those kinds of issues. A number of Democratic members who had initially said they were going to vote for this budget came to my office and said, we can't vote for it. These are individuals. Representatives say, I can't vote for it. In fact, one was almost in tears because they had been intimidated and harassed and threatened by the minority leader and by the governor. In fact, a couple of them, I'm told, were introduced to their primary opponents if they voted their conscience for an override. Now, you know, strong words, extortion, those kind of threats, I don't know. Those are words you all can follow up on. But those are comments that Democratic members came and said to me who wanted to vote for this budget because they knew it was right. But at the end of the day, we were there on September 11th for a properly noticed session. We took the votes. The override happened.
House Speaker Tim Moore responded to the threat of legal action.
I understand that Representative Jackson said he wants to file a lawsuit. Look, why am I not surprised? Sued about everything else. Why not this, right? We followed the House rules. In fact, I challenged Representative Jackson. Number one, who lied to you? What did they say? Point blank, say it. Number two, if you think that I said something that wasn't accurate, what was it? Say it. So far, I haven't seen or heard it. Number three, if you believe that the House of Representatives did not follow its rules, come forward and show me that. The only thing that I've heard them say is they didn't think it was fair. We followed the rules. The other thing I've heard them say is members were at 9/11 ceremonies. Remember that? I've gotten tons of, not tons, but I've gotten a handful of even threatening phone calls and messages where people say, why would you take a vote when Democrats were at a 9/11 ceremony? There was no 9/11 ceremony. One member of the House, Representative Garland Pierce, was at a 9/11 ceremony. So what about the other question? Where were the Democratic members? Where were they? They were, you know, I guess the total came to about 15. There were about 15 on the House floor. Well, where were the other 40? Well, Representative Butler, when during her tirade, actually made the point of saying, I believe the comment was, and we're downstairs working on maps right now. Well, we had a court order that said when you worked on maps, it had to be done in open, in public, had to be done. We had a room set up. Remember that 24-hour live stream we had the whole time? That was there for a reason, and it was there to comply with the order. So if Democratic members were, in fact, not on the House floor, where were they? I would submit to you that some of them, based on the admission of Representative Butler, were downstairs working on maps, just like she said they were.
That's Republican State House Speaker Tim Moore. He's responding to accusations from House Democratic leader Darrin Jackson. The back and forth is related to the House's controversial vote to override Governor Roy Cooper's veto of the state budget. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Climate activists are pushing for dramatic changes to how we live our lives and what they say is a necessary push to save the earth from warming and from greenhouse gas emissions. Electric vehicles are one piece of their planet-saving puzzle, but our next guest says that electric vehicles may not be the panacea that climate activists think they are. Dr. Don VanderVaart is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He's also the former secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, let's talk about the air and air pollution. Is our air dirtier today than it was, say, 10 years ago?
Well, certainly if you consider what we refer to as traditional air pollutants, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, particulate matter, all of those, yes, it's much cleaner than it's been ever, and it's even cleaner over the last 10 years.
So cleaner, not dirtier, as some people would allege, and that usually leads to their plan that would be dramatic changes in the things that we do, how we conduct ourselves, the energy, et cetera.
North Carolina is currently in compliance with all federal air quality standards and has been for a number of years. We're breathing clean air.
You recently made a really fascinating presentation to the Shaftesbury Society of the John Locke Foundation. By the way, you can see that at johnlocke.org on the Facebook page, also of the John Locke Foundation. You talked a lot about electric vehicles. And I got to tell you, just driving down the road in the Triangle where I'm located, I see a number of different EV models, and they're beautiful cars. I mean, I would consider buying one. But the problem is that the batteries, and we'll talk about that, at least in my view, do they actually reduce air pollution?
Well, they certainly shift air pollution. The pollution, if you were, that is generated when generating electricity that is used to charge these cars' batteries, is more remote. And instead of the pollution coming out of the tailpipe, as it does in an internal combustion engine, a gasoline car like most of us drive, the emissions are remote at a power station some 50 miles away.
Explain that.
Well, so when I take my Tesla, if I could afford a Tesla, and I they are beautiful.
They are indeed.
when I take that home and have it charged overnight, the electricity is coming from a nearby power station and elsewhere. That power station is typically in North Carolina, powered by some sort of fossil fuel. We do have some nuclear. And so the electricity that's sent to my garage has generated traditional pollution, as well as greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide.
You're describing simply a shift.
It is just a shift. And what's particularly concerning to me are two issues. One is there was some misleading information given out by the EPA a number of years ago that these cars are somehow more fuel efficient, some three times more fuel efficient. That isn't true, and the Department of Energy's methodology shows that. But the other more recent concern is that perhaps we're not prepared. Our grid is not sufficiently carbon CO2. The CO2 emissions haven't been lowered to enough in our grid to actually benefit from shifting the load from gasoline cars to electric vehicles. What I mean is, if we all parked our gasoline engines tomorrow and start driving electric vehicles, our electricity generating system would have to generate some 30% more electricity. And right now, that electricity would come from fossil fuel-fired electric steam stations.
And you're saying we would have to generate more electricity because people would be having
sure.
to charge the batteries.
Yeah, instead of buying gasoline, you'd have to be buying electricity. That electricity would be coming from a generating station, which would be fueled primarily by natural gas.
Now, I want to talk about something that some of our listeners might be thinking, well, gosh, Don Vandervaart sounds like, you know, he just hates electric vehicles. I don't think you hate electric
No.
vehicles. You're just talking about this is the reality of the science of this.
Let's look forward in the future when perhaps we have a electricity generating grid that is primarily nuclear or hydro with some solar. Now you've got electricity being generated with practically no CO2 emissions or greenhouse gas emissions, then electric vehicles could work fine. There are some performance issues in terms of range. Those are things that can be worked on. But I think the problem is today we have this misconception that if we drive electric vehicles with the current electricity generating mix that we have, we're going to somehow reduce CO2 and greenhouse gases. And that's simply not true. It's going to go in the opposite direction.
That's fascinating. And I wonder why environmentalists, who are smart people, I mean, they understand these things. And why aren't they acknowledging that?
Well, it's somewhat complicated. And it's only recently, for example, that some of this research has come out that shows that even natural gas can represent an increase in GHGs. That has to do with the potency of methane versus the potency of the global warming potency of methane versus the global warming potency of carbon dioxide. That's only recently come out. There was a letter sent by Professor Schindel from Duke, for example, to DEQ only a few months ago.
Department of Environmental Quality.
Correct. Only a few months ago, in which he explains the concern he's got with natural gas as being a source of greenhouse gases, almost as bad, if not worse, he says, than a coal-fired power plant. And that is the question I'm now bringing forward, is if that's true, any increase in the use of electricity in North Carolina will increase GHGs and exacerbate global warming to the extent GHGs play a role.
What about nuclear, Don? Because as I understand it, nuclear is greenhouse gas emission free. And yet, at least some vocal environmentalists who are pushing renewable energies at the same time reject nuclear. Why?
I don't think you can be serious talking about global warming if you're not talking nuclear. If we're to believe that the world as we know it is going to end shortly, the small amount of risk associated with nuclear waste pales in comparison. But in addition, nuclear power, especially from our older nuclear plants that have been paid for substantially, is the cheapest electricity that's on the grid right now. So the first step I'm advocating is that we move to incentivize the retention and continued operation of our existing nuclear fleet. That way we're at least not going backwards if one of those gets decommissioned and shut down. Because if they do, that load will be replaced by a fossil fuel-fired steam generating unit.
Now, the pushback that you're going to hear when our listeners hear you say that is, well, wait a second, what about storing those spent nuclear rods? We don't have a facility. We got the whole Yucca Mountain thing going on, but it's not approved. It's not open.
Correct. But all of the nuclear plants in America have done a great job storing nuclear waste to date. They've been operating for 30 to 40 years with no incident. That's going to continue. And again, the small risk associated with that pales in comparison with the risk we're being told of global warming.
Real quick, I want to ask you about battery technology, because it seems to me the longevity, the duration of a battery for an electric vehicle is critical to whether or not these things actually move forward. Are we on the horizon of something that is will allow us to go longer?
Battery technology is something that we desperately need to research and develop further. In the colder climates, these cars, because of the batteries are essentially a chemical reaction, and at cold temperatures, chemical reactions don't like to go. So there are a lot of issues in terms of range and performance that need to be figured out.
Don Vandervaart, thanks so much.
Thanks again.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.